This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Want to become the sort of developer top rail shops like Thoughtbot fight over? Join Upcase today to get the pro training, insider knowledge, access to Thoughtbot developers, and a community of like-minded learners you need. Hone core skills like Vim, Tmux, Git, and Rails by visiting upcase.com/halfoff to get 50% off your first month of Upcase. Let's get that junior out of your title and start leveling up today with Upcase.
Okay, you can make Albuquerque jokes. I'm in Albuquerque.
Oh, you're in Albuquerque?
Yeah.
Are you having an A1 day? I've been waiting for, like, since episode 4 to make that joke.
But see, I'm not at a car wash. You gotta wait till I go to a car wash, which I will probably do while I'm here.
Because that's what you do in Albuquerque.
Well, of course.
That and ride hot air balloons. That's all I know about Albuquerque. Well, and, you know, meth.
Well, that's what I'm here for. It's the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta. It's the largest hot air balloon event in the world.
Do you fly a hot air balloon?
I will be going up in one. I will not be flying one because my pilot's license is expired. But yes, I do fly.
Interesting. I was talking the other day how, like, when I was a kid, I used to see hot air balloons flying around all the time. I lived in the suburbs. That's probably why.
More common in the suburbs, yeah.
But, like, they would land on the golf course down the street or whatever, which I can't imagine was ever cleared. Like, and, like, a pickup truck would just kind of, like, ride down the road.
Yeah.
Throw the balloon in the back of the pickup truck.
I mean, the setup's sort of like, yeah, that is technically illegal, but most people won't complain. And then if they do complain to the FAA, like, there's just sort of this understanding, we'll stop. And in return for us, like, always being really prompt about responding to complaints and making sure the FAA doesn't get a lot of complaints, the FAA more or less leaves us alone.
Good luck with your balloon flying. I hope you don't crash into other balloons.
No, that's the thing. Well, A, so you couldn't crash into another balloon. Well, so there's only one way you could crash into another balloon, which is coming up from underneath them. And even then, that's really hard to do.
Why can't your balloons crash into each other?
From the side? Because you both have the exact same amount of thrust coming in the same direction. You're both being propelled by the wind.
Right.
And so in aviation, the least maneuverable vehicle always has the right of way. And then with balloons, there's one additional caveat where the person below you always has the right of way over you because you can see them, they can't see you.
But what do you do about that? Your only option is to go higher.
Yes. I mean, generally speaking, unless you're at an event like Balloon Fiesta, you never have to worry about that because just you're not going to get close enough to another balloon for it to be a problem. And they do lots of stuff with the timings of launches here to make sure that basically everybody's more or less at the same altitude if they're within, I don't remember the exact number. I think it's like a 400-foot radius. Basically, if you're in a hot air balloon, you're really not much of a danger to anybody other than yourself or anybody dumb enough to get in with you. Because, like, if you hit a building, which A, you have to be really dumb to
the building is going
to
win.
Because that's really hard to do. No, you'll, like, gently bounce off.
Okay.
Your biggest threat is power lines, which, I mean, to be fair, if you don't know what you're doing, then yeah, power lines are a major risk. But if you hit the power lines, right, you'll hurt yourself, and that's about it.
Could a drone do some damage to your balloon?
I suppose you could. No, a drone would probably win.
Yeah, so the drone would take your balloon down.
Depends on how big the drone is.
Gonna watch out.
The drone probably couldn't do much to the balloon.
Those Amazon delivery drones are gonna be pretty big. Better watch out. Good luck flying.
Buildings have right of way.
Yeah, the buildings have the right of way.
Buildings have right of way, right. They are technically less maneuverable.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
I am between projects, so I'm not currently on a client project, but I've been working on Upcase, which is our We'll Teach You Rails product. And I had an interesting experience the other day, and Ben reported that he wasn't able to load Upcase on his phone at all. Like, it just came up as a blank page.
Okay.
And so I looked at it, and I also was unable to load Upcase on my phone. We both have iOS devices on iOS 9, and we quickly realized that it was because content blockers, right? We both had content blockers installed, and we were like, well, what's happening is, like, upcase.com been flagged as, like, a tracker or something? Like, why is no content on this page working at all whatsoever? And then I noticed that, like, the 404 page rendered just fine. And I was like, okay, well, this, clearly that's not the problem. And also, like, there was a noticeable delay when you load the page, and then it became, and then it was blank. So it was like, all right, it's loading content. It's not blocking the entire domain.
So was the entire page flagged as an ad?
No, it was just like, it seems to be, like, it took a while to track down, because I was like, how am I going to track? You have no visibility. It's not like when you run Ghostery, you know, on your desktop browser, where it shows you, like, I'm blocking 8 things, and you can be like, well, what happens if I unblock this, right? So on iOS, you don't use iOS, but you get no visibility, basically. And maybe some of these blockers give you some sort of visibility, but when you're using Safari, you get no visibility into what was blocked. You have an option where you can say, like, open this site unrestricted, which means, like, show me what it would look like if there were no content blockers. And that worked. So then it's like, you have no, like, there's no binary search you can do to
right.
figure out what's causing the blank page. So I thought about it for a while, and what I was able to finally figure out to do was use ngrok, like set up localhost to serve Upcase, use ngrok to make it so I could get to it from my phone, and then manually start commenting things out, like, in the layout, so I could have, like, because I can't do that to production, right? I can't just, like, let me comment out this JavaScript and push this up.
No, yeah, it's just, I mean, it reminds me, right, of when I was talking about debugging OpenGL, and it's just like, there's literally nothing you can do other than throw shit at the wall and see what sticks.
Right.
It's the worst place.
So what it actually ended up being was, after the binary search was complete, it ended up being this thing called Visual Website Optimizer, which, not surprising that would get blocked, right? Because it's clearly doing some sort of tracking. It's built for A/B testing. So they must, you know, we're doing some visual tweaking of the page and doing some A/B testing based on that. But what's really weird is, like, I have Ghostery, and that is a different API than Safari content blockers are. But it does the same thing. Like, Safari, like, Ghostery is blocking, it reports that it's blocking Visual Website Optimizer on Upcase. But the page still loads fine. So there's something about the content blocker API, or maybe exactly how those blockers are going about blocking Visual Website Optimizer, that's causing the blank page. It's like Visual Website Optimizer is, like, loading enough to know, like, okay, here's my canvas, but then not loading enough to know, like, here's what I need to do to complete this A/B test or something like that. So the fix ended up being, like, contacting Visual Website Optimizer, and they were like, yeah, we're working on this. Here's a updated snippet to use. And so we put that snippet in, and it worked. I tried for a little while to, like, go through the snippet and be like, well, what did they change to fix this, right? Are they getting around the content blocker, or are they fixing the issue where if it's blocked, the website still loads fine? Like, I'm hoping that if it's blocked, the website still loads fine is the fix, not, like, we're tweaking it to get around these content blockers, right? But I don't know, because, like, it's one of those JavaScript snippets. It's all, like, condensed to one line and, like, with obfuscated variables because it's trying to be as small as possible, that kind of thing. So it's unclear to me which method it's taking. But it just, like, it's only been a couple weeks since iOS 9 has been out. And when it came out and I installed the content blocker, I was like, holy shit, the web is so much faster when you block all this garbage. And that's not to say Visual Website Optimizer is garbage. It just happens to get thrown out with the rest of the garbage, right?
Right.
It has value, you know, doing A/B testing is, you know, valuable, but it's also, like, part of the contract that I don't have to do that, right? If I don't want to download that and execute that, then I don't have to.
Right.
So when that first came out, I was like, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to see people start moving back to, like, server-side analytics? Because, like, I also block Google Analytics now, because why not? Like, I don't, like, whatever. I block, like, for the longest time, I didn't block any ads on the internet because I was like, well, this is how the internet makes, but they just got so terrible that it was like,
yeah.
And now that I have, like, I've been like, fine, I'm going to go block them. And frankly, all the ad blockers were pretty terrible for a long time as well. But now that I'm blocking it, like, stuff is so much faster that I just feel like this is just going to, like, I feel like it's going to catch on. And I feel like through word of mouth with people with iOS devices, and I'm sure something similar will happen on Android as well, although I don't know. I mean, Google's incentives are different, right?
Right.
But, like, I feel just through word of mouth, it'll be like, oh, did you install one blocker or whatever the hot new one is, right? And then people are like, what's that? And they're like, it speeds up your browsing. That's all you need to say. And people are like, okay, yeah, let me do that. And then you're like, holy crap, that does. And, like, I just feel like more and more people are going to do this, and it's going to be a bigger deal than it was on the desktop. On the desktop, it was almost negligible, right? Like, some people are going to block ads in JavaScript, you know, oh well. But
yeah.
I feel like on mobile phones, because traffic, first of all, mobile traffic is way up, and then also, like, I don't know, people like installing apps, right? So, like, like, you can install this app, and then it's going to make the web, like, noticeably way, way faster. Like, a content blocker on my desktop makes it seem faster. But not, like, oh, like the first time I loaded a page, I loaded boston.com, which is one of the worst websites ever. And it does terrible advertising. Like somebody did a report and said, like, if you visited a boston.com every day for a month or something like that, you would use like 7 gigabytes of data. I don't remember exactly what it was, but we'll link to it. It's something absurd where you're like, that's just unconscionable.
Yeah.
But just loading that page, I was like, oh, I'm never going back. Like it's so much faster now. Anyway, my point was, I think we're going to end up back in the spot where we're going to either be dodging content blockers by doing weird stuff, or we're just going to be like, well, I'm going to proxy everything on through my server, or I'm going to do like server-side analytics constantly.
Do you think that we're going to see an end game where like the ad blocker plus acceptable ads program, where when somebody is whitelisted as just the ads that you're serving are not ridiculously in your face and not using up an absurd amount of bandwidth, so we'll let it through? Do you think that's the end game for this?
I don't know, because that game also comes with money, right? So that game is like, it's not just, to my knowledge anyway, and I could be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, if you know that I'm wrong here. My knowledge is, like, yes, there is some semblance of like Adblock Plus or whatever being able to say, and I say Adblock Plus, I know the Adblock name is kind of like...
Well, Adblock got bought by Adblock Plus.
Okay. Okay.
That was a big hubbub.
So one of them has this approved ads thing, right?
Right.
And you basically can buy your way into it.
Yeah, no. So that particular program is super sketchy. I more mean the idea behind it, where it's just if content is non-intrusive and non-bandwidth intensive, that it gets let through.
Yeah, I think the trick in that is everybody has a different definition. Like some people really don't want to be tracked. And I'm one of those people who don't, like, I'm not super comfortable with being tracked all over the place by one company.
Oh no, we solved that with
Google.
Do not track, don't you remember?
Right. Yeah, I have that turned on too, but it doesn't do any good.
Problem solved. I'm sure everybody pays attention to it.
But like everything I do is like I'm logged in and I have email through Google, and then every site I visit is using Google Analytics. They know I'm logged in. And then like on the same day, I think it was on the same day that iOS 9 released with content blockers, either the same day or a couple days later, Google announced that they're going to allow people to advertise to customers by their email address. So you could like advertise to Sean at SeanTheProgrammer.com, right? Because Google knows you're logged in. So like not only are we just going to like say you can advertise to 24 to 35 year olds who are in this industry, we're going to say like if you have their email address, give it to us and we can advertise to you. So I don't know, that whole thing is starting to make me feel uncomfortable. But like from the technical perspective, I just feel like we are going to start to see like, already you can do, like, if you're using Mixpanel or Segment or whatever, like, Segment is what we try to use, which kind of stands in front of all of these different analytics stuff, right?
Right.
And you can track Segment events in JavaScript, or you can track them on the server. And I've always preferred to do them on the server, even though it's a little mean. It's a little messy because you have to stub them out in your specs.
Right.
You can't just, like, block the JavaScript.
Right.
So that's a little messier, but I've always preferred to do it that way. And I think that approach is going to start, like, people are going to start to have to do that. And I'm wondering even if people are going to start running, like, local analytics packages like we used to back in the day, where,
right,
like, everything would be logged to the database. And then, like, you start to worry about, like, I'm going to have to do that in the background because I don't want any part of that eating up any part of the request response cycle, which is why doing it in JavaScript asynchronously is actually really nice, because you're not eating up any of the server bandwidth. You're just, you know,
no, you're just using your user's battery life.
Right, the user's battery life, and which wasn't a concern when people started doing this, really. It was like,
right,
we're just going to let the user report this, and maybe they'll have JavaScript turned off, but probably not. And anyway, so that just made me, that's where I went down, like, the Upcase thing was like the realization of what I had feared, what I not necessarily feared, but thought might be coming. And I think that, like, we're going to start to see clients come to us and be like, we're not getting the analytics numbers that we used to get. And, like, either everybody's just going to have to adjust what they're expecting to get and be like, well, everything's going to be 5% lower. Or people are going to want real, true analytics. It's like, I want no part of the war of like trying to get around content blockers. So I'm hoping that that's not what ends up happening. But it probably, there's a lot of people with a lot of money at stake that'll probably just start trying to get around the content blockers. And then we're in an arms race rather than just saying, let's just do this stuff server side as much as possible.
Well, I think part of it, though, is that you can't necessarily get like as rich of an analytics flow with only server-side data, which is what a lot of people do want. But, you know, it makes, especially the sort of thing, like even on Upcase, right, that you guys do in terms of just analyzing churn rates and usage patterns, it's a lot harder to actually, especially if you have a business model that doesn't revolve around the user being signed in all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
but you also lose the ability to learn things like how long did they stay on a page.
Right. Yeah.
And that one in particular, or like, you know, back on Marshall Codex, we didn't have a loading bar at launch, and post launch, I was on this kick of like, let's not make any changes without some sort of analytics to back it up. And I had a theory that like the loading bar was going to help our conversion rates because our load times were still pretty long back then. And like there's an upper limit of how long you can go without any amount of feedback before you just assume it's broken.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured if we added a loading bar, we could push, you know, but that buys a little bit of time where we didn't necessarily have to fix the load time problem. And so I set up analytics to track the number of people who went to view a lesson and then was on the loading screen for 30 or more seconds, but did not stay long enough to actually start watching the lesson.
Right.
And like that was a really useful analytics funnel for us. And of course, now if we start doing everything server side, that's just the sort of thing you can never track actual interaction.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the solution is then. Like this, I mean, the best solution is advertisers come to their senses and stop doing terrible things. But they started doing those terrible things for a reason. So I don't see how this ends well for anybody involved.
I mean, really, right? The solution is everybody just not abuse this power and only use it to legitimately improve user experience in your products. But that's never going to happen. And then, of course, people also have differing opinions of how much is appropriate.
Right. So it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to get like download something that has like your opinions in it, right? And be like, right. These are my opinions. I want to allow Google Analytics, but disallow, you know, I don't know, Facebook tracking or whatever the case may be, right? I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I think there's going to be a bunch of technical issues that pop up. Like people who listen to the show will probably be asked to try and circumvent these things and or to like move these things to server side, that type of thing. And it'll be interesting to see how it goes. And maybe it won't. Maybe actually I'm overstating what the impact will be. Like maybe these content blockers will just be another nerdy thing like desktop content blockers are.
I mean, one interesting thing in terms of ad blockers, right, is not necessarily the ad providers, but the advertisers really, really, or even agencies really, really like ad blockers. Because if you have an ad blocker installed, you are never going to be a conversion. And so and so it actually helps to increase conversion rates and basically get more value out of the ads that you're displaying for less money. And then the ad networks, of course, hate it because they're getting less money because they're getting fewer impressions.
Right. I want to know who the people who do click on ads are. Like, I'm just so tuned out to them. I guess I've probably done it before, like particularly in search results where you're not quite sure. Like, oh, that was a sponsored ad. You're like, oh, no, that's not our sponsored listing. That's not what I wanted. But like after a while, you kind of just become aware of how Google lays these out. And you're like, oh, okay, now they have some sponsored stuff at the top where they never used to, like way back in the day. And you just become used to that. And you like you know that like on the right rail, there's going to be one of those skyscraper ads that's, you know, one of those skinny, yeah, tall things. And you're just going to ignore it.
I feel like that's sort of the objective even definition of like that's a very unobtrusive ad.
The skyscraper thing?
Like what Google does in their search results, both the skyscraper and even when they have the sponsored one at the top.
Right.
Like they have a different background color to clearly delineate it. Like it's very, unless you're just completely in autopilot, it's very difficult to accidentally mistake a sponsored ad for a search result. It's text only, short amounts, not in your face. You know, like I feel like that's sort of the epitome of a non-obtrusive ad.
Yeah. The genius of like the Google search result ad is that if there are no sponsored results for your search term, then your real search results start higher up on the page, right? So you can't always draw your eye to the same exact place and be confident that you're clicking like the top search result, right? So that's how it gets me sometimes is like, I'll be like, oh, like, or I'll find the opposite. Like I'll think I'm clicking on the top actual search result and I'm actually clicking on the third search result because the top two were not sponsored. They were just actual results.
Right.
anyway.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately though, right? People have been bashing that. I don't remember the magazine that did the poll, but the online news site that did like the really, really ridiculously leading poll and people still answered like, no, I'm going to use ad blockers, where the question was like, do you hate free content? But like, right, ultimately they do have a point, which is that there are companies whose business model revolves around free content and ads.
Right.
And like, we have to give them some sort of an out.
Yeah, I just don't know how it's going to happen. I just don't. I think it's going to be interesting. I don't have like a, I don't have anything, any stake in this other than like, I like the fast internet that I'm getting now that I'm blocking all of these things on a mobile device.
Yeah.
So if you can give me that experience and have it still be fast, then great. But I don't know how I'm going to know to go back to check, I guess is what I'm saying, right?
Like, yeah.
Maybe they've lost me and I'm just not going to be like, I was never going to buy anything anyway, like you said, but I don't know.
Well, it's weird, right? Because internet banner ads have always been just consistently the lowest value form of advertising imaginable. Like, not even by like a slim margin, but like the cost per conversion was such a ridiculously low ratio the vast majority of the time that was barely even necessarily worth your time as an advertiser. And I guess it's just like, so, right, we do the podcast. We have sponsors for the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I guess ThoughtBot also has some other financial incentives for the podcast as well. But I think ultimately the idea is generally the cost is mostly offset by the sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of. right. But like, so what's the equivalent? And I think that the ad reads on the podcast are pretty non-intrusive. So what's the equivalent of that for the web?
I would say a sponsored post on a blog or something like that, where it's a person talking about a service that they maybe have used before. And it's just one post and you can skip over it. It looks exactly like the rest of the site. It's native content, I think is what they call it. Native advertising or something, maybe. I might be making these terms up. But I think that that's equivalent. Like, people can skip over when we talk about, you know, whoever the sponsor is. The same thing, same way you can skip over the blog thing. It's costing you a little bit of bandwidth because you have to download us saying whoever the sponsor is, or you have to download the blog entry. But it's not like, what really got me was the stuff that would be like, for years, I didn't run an ad blocker because I was like, "This is part of the agreement, right?" But what really got me is the stuff that, like, it's now progressed from here's an advertisement, here's a banner advertisement, to like, here's some code I want you to run
right.
on your machine. And
yeah, when it got into Flash and JavaScript ads,
like, I'm really careful to run, like, I only download applications I want to run, right? So like, if you're starting to run so much code on my machine that like. If you're not requesting too much of my computer, then I'm willing to say, like, yep, that's cool. Anyway, I don't know. People probably don't tune in to hear us talk about ad blockers, but I thought from a perspective of somebody who actually had to debug this problem.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point of view, and I think you're right. People are going to have to start dealing with this more and more.
Right. So let's take a break and talk about our sponsor.
Do we actually have one this week?
Well, Upcase has been kind enough to offer a 50% discount to people who want to check out the service. So you can check out the link in the show notes. There's a coupon code there. You don't actually enter the coupon code in, so you just click the link to Upcase and you'll get the discount. So check that out in the show notes. What have you been working on?
Rails and Rust.
Rusty Rails.
Rusty Rails, yeah.
What are you doing in Rails land?
I'm sort of in the performance portion of the development cycle right now. There's some other stuff that I really wanted to do for Rails 5, but I just don't feel like I have enough time to really get any more features out. Yeah, so I've been focusing on performance and
I have a question.
Okay.
Before I forget, you can go back. Maybe this is what you're going to talk about. Maybe it's not. But I've been following along with the Rails core mailing list now. Like, I decided to join it a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a post about database connections. Have you been following that thread? Do you understand what's happening there? Because I'm a little bit lost on it.
There's a couple. Hold on. Let me pull that up really
fast. It's basically about somebody saying that, like, right now Rails reserves – I might get this wrong, but Rails reserves a database connection per thread and does not release it back to the pool. Does that sound reasonable?
Sort of.
Yeah, let's go with your thing, and then we'll come back to this, or we'll do another. We'll both read up on it and do another thing on it. But
yeah, let's talk about that one next week because I'm vaguely familiar with the thread that you're talking about. Jeremy is probably the one who's been responding the most, but I'd probably just need to read it more thoroughly to make sure.
Okay, performance land.
Yeah, so performance. So one of the ones that I had been meaning to tackle for a while was that saving a model got like 15% slower in 4.2. Maybe it's 20%. I don't remember which. Of course, that was one of those ones that came up, and I'm like, I'm going to fix that at some point, but it wasn't one of those, oh my God, I have to fix this right the hell now, because just writes are slow. If you were a write-heavy app, you'd probably be using NoSQL and not an RBDMS,
right.
And your most apps bottlenecks are reads, not writes.
Right. We talked about this, I think, a little bit on past episodes. We were like, a trade-off was made that most people are reading and not writing, and that this is a good trade-off to make.
Yeah. So I went ahead and started looking into, though, what was going on. And the reason writes were slow was, well, there are two reasons. So number one, I introduced that class called Attribute Set that lazily builds attribute objects as you read them. Now, during assignment, those attribute objects are always going to get created. That one turned out to really not be as big of a cost as you would think, but that was part of it. Then the second part was the way that we track mutation. So in 4.1, we don't track mutation at all. And as a side effect of that, like if you just look at the history of sort of, if you imagine the design or the thoughts that went into like why things are the way they are. So in the beginning, there was Rails and there was no mutation. And if you wanted to mutate a string, you would call will change bang, because like you're just not going to mutate a string on it. That's like a property of an active record model. And then the serialize macros added because somebody wanted to be able to use an array or a hash with MySQL, right? And it's very idiomatic to mutate arrays and hashes. So as a result, it was decided that an attribute that is serialized is always changed. There were a couple of reasons that this was unacceptable then when we get into 4.2. Well, okay, and then you fast forward to Rails 4, right? And now nobody really uses MySQL on new apps anymore. Everybody uses Postgres. And as of Rails 4, we supported the JSON, HStore, and array data types, all of which are arrays or hashes, all of which would be idiomatic to mutate, none of which had the same special treatment that serialize had. And that made them very difficult to use.
Right. So that means, so they don't have the same treatment, which means that like the treatment of serialize is we're just going to pretend this thing always changed.
Right.
And all this other stuff did what?
If you mutated it, you had to call will change bang.
Okay. And will change bang alerts the object that these fields are dirty.
Right. It tells active record like, mark this field as dirty regardless of whether you think it's actually changed or not.
Okay.
And so in 4.1, the way that mutation tracking works is when you assign a value, we compare it to the previous value. If those two things are different, we stick it in the hash. And then after you finish saving, we then take that hash and stick it into a different instance variable called previous changes, because there's a very, presumably very not used feature of Rails where you can not only ask if something has changed and what the previous value was, you can also ask if it was changed before the last time you called save and what the previous value before that assignment was.
Okay.
You only go two steps back though. there were a variety of reasons why I needed serialized to not always assume to be changed. I usually in my talks talk about like it was because I wanted to start guaranteeing certain contracts about attribute assignment and yada, yada, yada. Really, it was just because I wanted to refactor that code and there was a 5-line method that I needed to get rid of, and getting rid of that method required detecting mutations across all of active record, which maybe is a little overkill, but hey, you know, it works out. So the way I do that is I keep a copy of the database representation when we pull it out of the database. And then when we're checking if something's changed, I take the current value and then cast it for the database and see if the database representation is different. Which then, of course, right, that is more work, so it's going to be a little bit slower. But not like painfully so, and there's certain little optimizations that we're always sort of in the realm of like, I could do this optimization, I will do this optimization at some point. Like, for example, I may have even done this in 4.2. I don't actually remember off the top of my head, but like you can't mutate something if you've never read it. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to check things that you've never read.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
And stuff like that. Now, ultimately, though, so then what this meant was the method changed attributes, which used to just in active model just returns this hash that's in an instance variable. And then active record, I override that method to call super.reverse merge and then also go check for all of the attributes that have been mutated. And then there's another method called changes, which is a hash where the key is the name of the attribute and the value is an array containing the previous value and the current value. So it turned out the main bottleneck was, so changes is implemented in terms of changed attributes. And so it wasn't even the mutation detection. It was after you finish saving. When I said we copy that hash into another instance variable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now copying that actually is very expensive. Like computing that hash is pretty expensive. So, And all of that's there for a feature that most people are never going to use. But that's where most of the cost was. So I started looking at ways to optimize that away. And ultimately what I ended up doing was introducing a new object called Mutation Tracker, which rather than comparing an attribute to its database representation. Oh, and the other one was that when you assigned it, I then had to eagerly like build a database representation at that point in time. And so I started doing the mutation tracker was I would do a deep copy of the attributes, like the attribute set when it gets created. And then I would keep that attribute set and compare it to the current attribute set. And I would still do the database. I think I still do the database comparison, although I don't remember off the top of my head if that was what I was doing or not. But like now I always had a thing where if I ask for the database representation of the attribute in the first attribute set, that's guaranteed to be different than the one that I get out of the second attribute set. And then changes applied becomes free because now like I have these two attribute sets, right? And all the logic for previously changed is the exact same logic, but just, you know, compared to two attribute sets, one further step removed. And so I just clone the attribute set, shallow copy the second time, and then just move the current mutation tracker into another instance variable.
Why can you shallow copy the second time and not the first time?
Because the attribute objects are immutable.
Oh, right, right.
And okay. We have the database representation because we just sent it to the database.
Right.
So that all worked, and then I realized that I made reads 20% slower because that meant that main thing was when you first initialize it, right? I do a deep copy of the attribute objects, and that turns out to be expensive.
Playing whack-a-mole here.
Yeah, playing whack-a-mole, right? So I sort of took a step back and reanalyzed everything, right? And so I sort of went with a structure that I'd been wanting to do for a while, but I was going to wait till the attribute assignment infrastructure was moved up to active model, because basically now active record completely re-implements every method from Dirty and shares no code with active model. But so basically, since the attribute objects are immutable, whenever you assign, it doesn't mutate the attribute object. It builds a new attribute object. And then the attribute set is mutable. So what I can do is I can have, when you assign to an attribute, I can have each attribute keep a reference to the attribute it was created from.
Mm-hmm.
And so by doing that, so now I know two things. Have you been read? Have you been written? If you haven't been read, I know you can't be mutated. And if you haven't been written, I know you can't have changed from assignment. And so then I can ask each attribute pretty lazily, like, hey, compare yourself to your ancestor or to the earliest known ancestor. And if you haven't been read, skip the mutation detection. If you haven't been written, if you have no ancestors, skip assignment checking. And then I can also do little optimizations. Like, so when I say I have a method called original value from database, and on the from database version of attribute, I just return value before typecast, and then on all of the other ones, I do a round trip of the typecasting. So cast it, and cast it from the before typecast, and then take that and cast that for the database. And then in changes applied, now because these objects are immutable, like the previous changes is just that tree, and then the current set of attributes is just basically I just take the head of the list and cut off the tail. And so then each attribute individually becomes basically a singly linked list representing a state transition or a snapshot of every state that it's been in,
right,
barring mutations, because, of course, I can't have a version of it kept around from like before you mutated it.
But you can still detect if it has been mutated.
Right. Exactly. And so all of that, I haven't checked since like 2 days ago to make sure that RubyBench shows the same numbers I was showing. On my machine, I was showing that we're slightly faster.
Slightly faster for?
Reads than we were in 4.2. I've also noticed a couple of times now RubyBench seems to show different numbers than I see on my machine. so I'm still waiting on that. And then there's still just some little optimizations I can do there. One of the other side effects of this that I've been trying to really hammer in is like if you turn off partial writes, make everything go way faster. But basically this ultimately, this optimization comes from the place that I get a lot of my optimizations out of, which is like just thinking about the common usage of active record. So ultimately what I've done here is I've just made dirty tracking lazy. So if you're not going to save, if you're not assigning attributes and if you're not saving to the database, you're not going to pay any costs that you would have paid for writes.
So you only care about checking whether or not commuting, whether or not something's dirty, if you ask if something's dirty.
Correct.
Basically.
And we ask if something's dirty when we save because we have partial writes enabled by default.
And partial writes is the thing that says, like, I'm only going to write to the database stuff I know has changed.
Exactly. And that's why we needed to have serialized be always dirty originally, was because if it wasn't always dirty, then you would mutate it and it wouldn't save those changes to the database.
So is partial writes a way, and maybe I'm missing something, but is it a way to provide some semblance of, like, concurrency by obscurity, kind of. Like,
yeah, like it gives you kind of, sort of, maybe solves certain race conditions in that right. if two people edit the same form but only fill out different fields, they wouldn't stomp on each other's toes.
Right.
I think it's also just a case that, at least MySQL, I kind of have a feeling this isn't true of Postgres, but I've never looked too closely into it. But at least on MySQL, like, you pay re-indexing costs on assigning a field to the same value in an update statement.
Mm, okay. So this would allow you to avoid those re-indexing costs by only changing the fields you know have actually changed.
Right. And that was originally, like, the quote-unquote issue. Because, right, saying that a serialized attribute is always changed, regardless of anything else, is kind of a bug. Because, like, changed is lying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, but the original quote unquote bug report for this was specifically saying that, like, hey, like, serialized might actually be a really large data structure, and sending that to the database over and over again if you don't touch it is really expensive.
Right.
Like, even if you're not indexing, just the fact that you're sending that much data over the wire.
Yep. That makes sense.
So
is disabling partial writes something you would suggest? Can you do that? Is that a config option?
Yeah, you just do. You don't have to disable it for your whole app. You can disable it on a per model basis. You just do self.partialWrites equals false in your class.
Is that something you would suggest?
I don't know if I would go so far as to say it's something I would suggest. I would definitely say it's something that I would recommend considering whether partialWrites adds anything, because I am trying to make sure. I am trying to make it. I don't know if I'll be able to get with partialWrites on too much performance out of reads or writes for that matter. Compared to 4.2. But I do think I can get us a huge win, especially for writes, if you have partial writes turned off.
Yeah, I've never seen partial writes turned off, though.
No, nor have I, but nobody, it's because nobody ever thinks about it.
Right. So if this became a thing where it was like, test your app with partial writes on and partial writes off and see what's faster, then maybe more people would try it.
Yeah. I think right now, most apps will see absolutely no difference whatsoever.
Right.
Like, I don't think partial writes actually gives any benefit to most apps.
Okay, and then your plan is that in 5.0 you would see a speed boost by having partial writes off.
Yeah, but not necessarily speed boost in, like, a major performance hotspot.
Okay.
Because again, right, like, the time it takes to save an active record model is pretty trivial amount of work compared to, like, an HTTP request and round tripping to the database.
So if you disabled partial writes, does that also disable dirty or no?
It doesn't disable dirty, but because of the way I've implemented dirty in 5, you will not pay any cost for dirty checking. Because partial writes is implemented in terms of dirty checking.
Right. Okay.
So then if you never call, so if you don't, it won't disable dirty checking, but you won't pay the cost.
Right. You won't pay the cost for when you call save. You won't pay the dirty checking.
Yeah, you won't
cost.
Pay the going and checking if
right.
every.
But if you explicitly check. Call dirt, like if you explicitly somewhere are checking, like, is this field dirty for whatever right. reason?
Then you'll still pay that cost for that specific field only.
That's the underscore changed query method, right?
Yeah, there's a couple. But yeah, attribute underscore changed question method, right. question mark is how you can. And then you can also get like previous underscore attribute name to get the old value.
Right.
Or it might be actually underscore was. Hmm. Oh, underscore was is the current value. And then previously underscore attribute is like the before I signed it, before the last time I called save. I don't know why this feature exists.
Okay. Well, good luck.
I legitimately don't.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But yeah, anyway, so that's, you know, but I'm mostly just looking at stuff like that. Another one that I'm not really sure I'm going to be able to do much about, but we have an issue in Shopify where we use YAML pretty extensively for caching. We have a thing called identity cache, which is basically an identity map that lives in memcached and operates on associations. And it's a public gem, and you can go look at it. And it operates basically on the YAML encoding by default. And I made the size of a YAML encoded active record model like 3 times larger in 4.2.
Hmm. Why?
Because the old one was incorrect and wasn't actually persisting enough data.
Okay.
There's a little bit I can do. So basically what I'm doing right now is I'm just straight up serializing the attribute set in its entirety, which means every attribute object gets serialized. And then the type objects get serialized. So one place I could see a win is that the type object, I could make sure to, instead of serializing the type object all of the time, I could instead have I could either serialize the type object or a flag that says I am using the type that was provided by the class. But the reason I'm serializing the type object is because sometimes the type object will be different because your query might have actually returned something completely different. Like, it might be because you're a new column because you did select count star as whatever, or it might be like a column that exists but has a different type because you did select count star as name from users.
Right.
So there's that stuff, and then also persisting dirty state, and like there's just a bunch of information that was missing. And basically, like, I sort of got into a little bit of an argument with another developer who's like, yeah, you did this, but like that size increase is unacceptable for us here. I'm like, okay, cool. Having a record round trip from YAML and not behave exactly the same for every single method called on it after round tripping as before is unacceptable for Rails. And
right.
Like, this is the trade-off. So sorry. Right. We can, you know, use something different if size is a major concern.
So you don't think you're gonna be able to do much about that?
Yeah, and the stuff I can do, like, I would have to reach into so many internals of so many collaborating objects right. for such a small win on what I... And if you're somebody who's, like, specifically affected by this, and, like, I see it as a pretty niche use case. If I'm wrong, shoot me an email. But right now, I feel like using YAML for like, long-term persistence, where size is a major factor, is pretty niche. And there's probably better formats that we can use.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to introduce something like that into ActiveRecord proper, where like it's some sort of persistence format that's more guaranteed to remain consistent across versions. Oh, and if anybody's affected by this, I did fix it's going to be in 4.2.5 and 5.0, but like I did fix it so that you can now load records that were serialized to YAML in 4.1. I forgot to add the backwards. I actually fixed it in master months ago and just forgot to backward it, but I backported it now. So yeah, but one of the features I'd love to add is some sort of persistence format that's a little bit more independent of like Ruby versions and Rails versions, and is more targeted at like, I'm using this thing for caching, and I don't care about persisting things like dirty checking, and I'm never going to be using this on a record that has like custom things from a like additional attributes from a custom select clause, and maybe even go so far as to like cache the after typecast version of it in this persistence format. So that way when you read it out, like you skip type coercion. So that way your reads will be faster. You do more work on writes, and there's all kinds of edge cases that we now have to consider if we go that route, because like now we have to deal with any arbitrary user object. But we could always do something like have a really intelligent way of representing anything that could be represented in JSON. And then if we see anything we don't recognize, like fall back to Marshall.
Right.
But anyway, I don't know. That's something I think would be useful to add. Like, there are use cases for it and is something I'm thinking about.
Cool. Good luck.
Thanks.
I feel like I'm always wishing you luck because I have no desire to tackle the problems you're tackling.
What? Make Rails 5 faster than Rails 4.2, like, in a way that impacts most apps.
I'm happy that you're doing it. And I'm also happy that I'm not doing it.
Hopefully I'll find a few more big performance wins before we ship. I would really like to have Rails 5 be like noticeably faster than 4.2.
Yeah, that'd be cool. When are we talking about beta? Beta is going to be August. We're in October.
Yep. It still says fall 2015 in Campfire, and okay, we're getting close to like that not even qualifying. So right.
I think I had said Christmas when they said August. I was like Christmas, just based on past experience with major Rails release. So.
Well, Christmas is usually when we do the actual release, right, but not necessarily
right.
the beta.
Right. I was thinking beta release candidate around Christmas time.
Yeah.
It seems a little...
I mean, I don't know. We got to get Action Cable figured out still. And then I guess now we have Turbolinks 5 to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when the features that I wish we didn't have in Rails at all are figured out, we'll ship.
Okay. Sounds good. And when you make it a lot faster.
And when I make it a lot faster.
Okay.
With WebSockets and Turbo.
Yeah. You need Turbo Record. Forget this Active Record thing.
You don't need your app to be fast because you have Turbo Links making it fast for you.
Mm-hmm. This is true.
All right. Let's wrap up.
Anyway, show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/37.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any others, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
As always, thanks for listening to the Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time. I will make Active Record 1% faster for every 5-star review we get on iTunes between now and the next episode. Let's see if
okay.
that works.
Okay, cool.